Margaret Drabble is one of the most respected novelists in her native England. She was one of the first women novelists to write about the dilemmas of career and family faced by contemporary women. As Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood puts it, Drabble was one of the first writers to take women's domestic life, the diapers, the dishes, the rashes, and treat it as subject matter suitable for literature. Drabble has written 11 novels since 1963, including The Garrick Year, The Needle's Eye, The Ice Age, and The Middle Ground. She spent the first half of the 1980s editing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, and then she returned to fiction. The two books she's written since, The Radiant Way and A Natural Curiosity, are about the same characters, three middle-aged professional women living in contemporary England. I asked Margaret Drabble if she's been trying new things and writing in a new voice since her return to fiction.
Yes, I think I have. One of the reasons for the gap was that I was rather tired with what I had been doing. I thought I'd come to the end of a particular vein, and I wanted to write a different kind of book. I wasn't sure whether I was able to, but I wanted to have a go.
What kinds of differences were you looking for?
Well, I wanted to write a less interior, more exterior book. I wanted to write a book that jumped around a lot. I was tired of looking deep into the psyches of characters, and I was tired of the introspective novel, I suppose. And I was also tired of the domestic novel. The novel that I published in 1980, The Middle Ground, is a very domestic novel, although it reaches out from its domestic centre. And I wanted to write a book that was simply more mobile.
Why were you tired of writing in such an introspective voice?
I think because I'd done all the introspection I needed to do. I'd sort of solved all the problems. And there was nothing more in there that I wanted to say. I was much more interested, which I think is very common at my age, in what was going on around me than in worrying and angst about my own life and problems.
So, A Natural Curiosity, it strikes me, for instance, is more about the evil side of human nature, in a way. Why that exists? What are we to make of it? Can we change it? Is there a way of getting around it?
Yes, it's a more abstract question, and it comes up in the book in many forms, some of them sort of fairly black comic forms. But it's not an interior book. It's asking a question about the whole of human nature, if you like.
Well, one of your characters, a woman, visits a serial murderer repeatedly, and this murderer killed one of her students. Can you explain her preoccupation with trying to understand him?
Well, yes. I mean, it seems to me a very natural curiosity, which is why I gave the book its title, because I find it very hard, as Alex Bowen in the novel finds it hard, to believe that people enjoy murdering people, and that I also find it hard to believe that psychotic characters are evil. I think it's much more likely that something went wrong, with a connection somewhere in childhood. And Alex, of course, during the novel, is interested, indeed, sort of obsessed with proving that this is the case, that he didn't commit the murders out of evil. Because when you see him, he, like many serial murderers, is a mild, quiet-looking young man who looks as though he wouldn't hurt a fly. So she's interested in the enigma of this kind of personality.
I think the other side is taken by a character named Brian, who thinks that Terry Waite really shouldn't have tried to free the hostages. He says, why can't people accept the limitations of the human condition instead of trying to show off all the time?
That's quite right. Absolutely. And I think these are two contrasting positions. I think it's also fair to say that Alex wasn't trying to show off. I mean, she does her prison visiting quite modestly and secretly. She doesn't go around saying that she is a martyr.
What about just accepting the limitations of the human condition?
I don't think that's possible.
You don't think it's possible?
No, I don't. I think that Brian would like to think it's possible, but it's not. One has to keep looking.
Mm-hmm.
One has to keep looking for explanations. That's why we're here, or one of the reasons why we're here. It's certainly one of the reasons why I think I'm here, is to ask questions for which there are no answers.
Novelist Margaret Drabble is my guest. Her new book is called A Natural Curiosity. You know, getting back to the 7-year hiatus that you took from fiction, I found myself looking to The Middle Ground, your novel right before the hiatus, for some clues to why you stopped writing fiction for a while. And I'd like to just read one paragraph from that novel. And this paragraph describes some of the reasons why a woman who's a journalist feels she's suddenly facing both a midlife crisis and professional restlessness. The area which she had made her own seemed ever more confining. What had seemed unexplored terrain became well-trodden as more and more women began to write about menstruation, battered wives, low career expectations for girls. In short, as the women's movement gathered momentum. She found herself trapped in stale repetition and depressed by the fact that as everyone else got more interested in women, she became less and less so. The feeling of deep boredom which overcame her when she opened a woman's novel frightened her.
Yes.
Does that describe how you were feeling at the time?
Well, I mean, that's a parody of how I was feeling. But yes, obviously some of that feeling I recognise very much, that what had seemed fresh and interesting is becomes familiar. And when everybody's doing it, you're glad they're doing it. You're glad that these topics are sort of constantly presented for public discussion. But you don't want to go on doing it yourself. You yourself feel you've done that bit. It's time to move on. And I think this is a very normal feeling. Also, I'd like to point out that the character in the novel, Kate, is a journalist with a weekly column. So every week she has to find a subject to bang on about. And she's finding this a bit tedious. I think it's probably more difficult to write a weekly column than to write a novel.
But with you now, you had written about women's lives in your novels, and the territory you wrote was being covered by other women as you get older. Now, you published your first novel in 62 or 63.
Yeah.
But did you start feeling like the territory was becoming more confining with the arrival of more women novelists, more serious women novelists?
I suppose I felt that the territory was becoming overtrodden. And that particular kind of novel I no longer wanted to write. Other people were writing it. I had written mine, and mine were there on the shelf. I mean, I haven't unwritten them. They still stand there, and they probably speak to women in their 30s, as they did when I was in my 30s. In fact, I know they do, because people tell me so. But I knew that for me there was something else that I ought to be doing. It's as though you hand on the torch. That sounds a bit grandiose and pompous, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, your character in The Middle Ground expresses not only her boredom with women's novels, but her horror at the commercialization of the feminist novel. Were you finding that too, the commercialization of the feminist novel?
Well, yes, I mean, I do find this disturbing. I find the whole idea of being a professional feminist rather worrying. And there's something in the publishing industry and the media, as soon as they discover something, you know, it's women's novels, or it's the Latin American novel, or it's magic realism, and I find that uncomfortable. I don't want to pander to a kind of trivialization and commercialization of something that I take very seriously. I don't like the idea that I, as a woman novelist, should support all other women novelists, regardless of whether I think they're any good or not. And that is certainly a feeling you get in some parts of the so-called feminist movement.
Were these sentiments ever uncomfortable for you to admit to?
No, not at all. I'm delighted to admit to them.
Mm-hmm.
Other people don't like them, but I don't feel ashamed of them at all. I think they should feel ashamed of themselves, myself.
Although you have been an important writer for many feminist readers and writers, I'm wondering if you identified with the feminist movement. You started writing in the early 60s, and you had started to establish yourself before the renaissance of the feminist movement in the late 60s.
That's right. I predate it, and some of my books were its raw material. And I have been processed, and sometimes I'm not entirely happy with the processing. I mean, I can process my own work.
What do you mean you've been processed?
Well, people have interpreted my work in ways and presented it to the public in ways that I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, people are at liberty to do this, of course, that's fine, but I'm at liberty to say that's not quite what I meant, and anyway, I'm now off to do something else, thank you very much.
Are you saying that you haven't seen your novels as feminist novels?
No, not at all. I don't think I'm the same kind of feminist that the feminists are, who are picking up my points. I think there are many versions of feminism. I think that life is an extremely complex business, and that one of the points of writing novels is to show that it is complicated, and that if you write a scene in which a woman asks her husband to start the car on a frosty morning because she can't get it going, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. If you write a scene in which a woman is a bad cook, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. If you write a scene in which a woman is a good cook, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. It's the simplification of feminist criticism which sometimes irritates me, and I try to get my characters to edge pretty quickly out of the pigeonholes that people are trying to put them into. Because to me, the confusion, the muddle, the struggling between ideology and reality is what makes a novel and life real and interesting.
I've read that your mother was a feminist, and I was wondering in what respect.
She was a feminist in that she read Bernard Shaw and The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, and she believed that women should be educated, and she thought it was disgraceful to spend more on educating your sons than your daughters. And she would have liked a career had society permitted her to have one. She was a teacher, but when she married, as happened in those days, she had to leave her job. When the war broke out and the men were called up, she went back to her job as a teacher. When the war ended, she was dismissed again. And this made her rather a vocal feminist at times. But she wasn't a very effective one because society didn't permit her to be so. And also she became very embittered. I think that hatred and embitteredness, if that's a word, are dangerous for people. They make them very unhappy and they make them ineffective at the same time.
But since she was fighting for rights for women, you know, personally, did you grow up just taking that for granted that women should be equal and that women could work?
Well, life is never as simple as that. I mean, we grew up taking it for granted that women were intellectually equal. There was no suggestion in our household that they weren't, and it would have been inappropriate if they had been, because we were clever girls, you know, we were scholarship girls. It was obvious that we were equal intellectually. But when it actually came to the job market and to having careers, of course it became much, much more opaque and confused, as my mother's life had been. She wanted us, I think, to marry and have babies. She didn't want us to do it as soon as we did. We married and had babies to get away from her. And life is not, you know, not clear. And looking back, one looks back again and again, as my character Liz Headland looks back in A Natural Curiosity for the skeletons in your family cupboard. And although I can honestly say that my mother was a feminist, I can also honestly say that she probably wasn't a very good influence in some respects.
Like what?
The image she gave of domestic life was negative. She didn't like other people. She was, as I said, embittered and never saw that she herself could take those steps that would alter her life. She never took them. She prided herself on her domestic life, which she made into a sort of prison for herself, which was contradictory to her theory, but is in practice what she did.
I'm surprised that your reaction wasn't to see domestic life as a prison and avoid it yourself, instead of having babies at such a young age.
Well, I did both. I mean, I both had babies at a young age, and I saw what I was doing as a prison, and then I got out of it. I mean, I think what had happened was that my generation of women in the late 50s and early 60s, we'd been told by our mothers, many of whom were emancipated, I mean, there was emancipation before the 1960s, that we should go to college, that we could have jobs, and also we could be fulfilled women and we could have babies too. I mean, the sort of spinster profession of the 1930s was no longer the model for us. We were going to do everything. And we tried to do everything, and then we realised that doing everything was exhausting. And out of this sense of exhaustion and conflict and competition with ourselves rose the woman's novel, then rose feminist literary theory and the women's movement itself, out of this ideal that we couldn't realize.
You started out in theater before you wrote, and one of the things that's always mentioned about your early theater days is that you understudied Vanessa Redgrave in a production of Cymbeline.
That's right.
How serious were you about acting, and what were your insecurities, if you had any, about that profession?
I was very serious about being an actress, and I think if I hadn't had children so quickly, I would be an actress now, in that I think I could have earned my living. I wasn't a very varied actress. I was rather a heavyweight. But I certainly was being offered work. But then with children, it became increasingly difficult and increasingly unattractive. And I began to see that this wasn't going to work, really. Acting as a profession is a very unsatisfactory way of life. It's an unsatisfactory lifestyle. And I began to see there were ways where I could have more control over what I was doing.
How did you start writing?
Well, I wrote my first novel while I was still an actress, and I wrote it in the evenings. Um, I don't I wasn't acting at the time. My first husband was at the Royal Shakespeare Company at Stratford, and I was pregnant, expecting my first baby, and I wrote my first novel in the evenings then. And I did it really just to give myself something to do.
When you were in your 20s, a young mother, did you think of yourself as writing about women in a way that women hadn't much written about before in fiction?
I don't think I was conscious of it. I just wrote about what was there. And it was only when the books were published and people began to tell me what they were about that I realised that perhaps there wasn't all that much written about this particular social phenomenon, the young graduate mother. I remember I went to Paris on a travel grant in 1966 when I had three young children, and I took the three young children with me, of course. I mean, that's what I did. And I remember my publishers, my French publishers and my English publishers, sort of saying, who did I want to meet in Paris? And I said, well, I'd like to meet young women writers of about my own age. And there weren't any. There just weren't any. I mean, the woman's novel hadn't been invented in France. There was a long hiatus. And there just weren't any people like me. Whereas in England, there were beginning to be people like me.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, we were talking earlier about how you felt that the feminist novel had become commercialized, and that the subjects you had been exploring were already being explored by so many people once, I guess, we had the 1970s. Was your initial feeling when more women started writing fiction, when there were more feminist novels, one of companionship, of being glad to be able to share the field with other women?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it was very exciting to find that, and there were other people doing it. And I still feel that. I mean, some of my best friends are women novelists.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to differentiate between those who are jumping on the bandwagon and those who are doing it for real. And I think there is a distinction. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not going to name the names of those who I think jump on the bandwagon, but I could list a long list of women writers, starting with Doris Lessing and coming down to Mary Gordon, who I think are writing wonderful fiction.
Mm-hmm. Let's move up ahead in time a little bit. While you were taking your hiatus from fiction and writing, editing the Oxford Companion to Literature, did you find it a relief to be writing nonfiction and to be writing short biography?
Yes, I did. I thought it was a relief to be doing something constructive, by which I mean that at the end of every day I'd covered more paper and I'd put another little piece into the jigsaw. I'd done another letter of the alphabet. Well, actually, that's not true, because a letter of the alphabet would take me about 9 months. But I did actually feel I'd moved along a bit. And that was very satisfying. I mean, part of me has always rather liked filing systems and sorting things out and making columns and writing out vocabularies. And this part hadn't been used very much lately. So it was good fun having a go at something totally different. It was also quite sociable, which writing novels isn't. In fact, it was too sociable. I had a full-time assistant kind of living in my house because I worked at home, and she and I had lunch together every day for 5 years. But that was quite fun, being in an office situation in my own house and corresponding with people and sort of having lunches with people and, pestering everybody I knew about what to do next with the Oxford Companion, which I would never do with a novel.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to write your own entry?
I didn't have an entry.
Why not?
I didn't put myself in, because I thought if I put myself in, everybody would complain and say, who does she think she is? And if I left myself out, everybody would say, why has she left herself out, which is much pleasanter for me.
But now you won't be in it until there's another edition.
Well, my assistant is actually, at the moment, I trust, compiling a 20th century companion. I said I didn't want any truck with this because it would bring me into too dangerous territory. But that will give her an opportunity to put in a lot of younger writers who were ineligible for our volume, and also people like me who were on the borderline.
Mm-hmm. You are married now to the biographer Michael Holroyd, who just completed the second volume in a 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw. And he was, in fact, a guest on our program just about a week ago. And I had asked him about this, and I'd like to ask you as well. And that's about your living relationship. You live nearby but in separate houses from each other. I find that just a very interesting arrangement, and I really understand the drive for privacy, which is what I suppose is behind that arrangement. But I guess what I'd like to ask you is why get married? if you're going to live separately?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I don't know if I can give you a very satisfactory answer. I think, did you ask Michael this?
Not in those words exactly, because I think it wasn't until after the interview that I realized that was really what my question was.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. I mean, the lifestyle is absolutely fine and obviously pleasant, and a lot of people would like to do it if they had two houses or could afford to do it. But, I mean, particularly if they married kind of later in life, as we did. But why we got married is a sort of mystery to me. I think it's something to do with the fact that Michael and I, we'd been going out together and sort of taking one another out for meals for quite a long time. But Michael and I are both very polite people and rather reserved and private people in a strange way. That's something we have very much in common. And we were so polite that we couldn't quite work out what the other person wanted all the time. And I think we thought if we got married, it would be a shortcut through a lot of that. It would be easier to cut through all that and just know that we were a couple, even if we didn't seem to be a couple or look like a couple, that on one level we were a couple and we could rely on each other in a particular kind of way. It also made it very convenient with going on lecture tours for the British Council, because we could travel together. And although I missed him this time in America, quite often we do get to travel together. And it's very nice to travel together as husband and wife and be and feel that, you know, we are accepted as a couple without people worrying about whether we're a couple or not.
Okay. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.